Chapter 26. The city is the seat of the local parliament of Virginia, and in its shady legislative halls, some orators were drowsily holding forth to the hot noonday. By dint of constant repetition, however, these constitutional sights had very little more interest for me than so many parochial vestries, and I was glad to exchange this one for a lounge in a well-arranged public library of some 10,000 volumes, and a visit to a tobacco manufactory, where the workmen are all slaves. I saw in this place the whole process of picking, rolling, pressing, drying, packing in casks, and branding. All the tobacco thus dealt with was in course of manufacture for chewing, and one would have supposed there was enough in that one storehouse to have filled even the comprehensive jaws of America. In this form, the weed looks like the oil cake on which we fatten cattle, and even without reference to its consequences, is sufficiently uninviting. Many of the workmen appeared to be strong men, and it is hardly necessary to add that they were all laboring quietly then. After 2 o'clock in the day, they are allowed to sing a certain number at a time. The hour striking, while I was there, some 20 sang a hymn in parts, and sang it by no means ill, pursuing their work meanwhile. A bell rang as I was about to leave, and they all poured forth into a building on the opposite side of the street to dinner. I said several times that I should like to see them at their meal, but as the gentleman to whom I mentioned this desire appeared to be suddenly taken rather deaf, I did not pursue the request. Of their appearance I shall have something to say presently. On the following day, I visited a plantation or farm of about 1,200 acres on the opposite bank of the river. Here again, although I went down with the owner of the estate, to the quarter, apostrophe as that part of it in which the slaves live is called, I was not invited to enter into any of their huts. All I saw of them was that they were very crazy, wretched cabins, near to which groups of half-naked children basked in the sun, or wallowed on the moldy ground. But I believe that this gentleman is a considerate and excellent master, who inherited his 50 slaves, and is neither a buyer nor a seller of human stock. And I am sure, from my own observation and conviction, that he is a kind-hearted, worthy man. The planter's house was an airy, rustic dwelling that brought Defoe's description of such places strongly to my recollection. The day was very warm, but the blinds being all closed, and the windows and doors set wide open, a shady coolness rustled through the rooms, which was exquisitely refreshing after the glare and heat without. Before the windows was an open piazza, where, in what they call the hot weather, whatever that may be, they sling hammocks, and drink and doze luxuriously. I do not know how their cool rejections may taste within the hammocks, but, having experience, I can report that, out of them, the mounds of ices and the bowls of mint julep and sherry cobbler they make in these latitudes are refreshments never to be thought of afterwards, in summer, by those who would preserve contented minds. There are two bridges across the river. One belongs to the railroad, and the other, which is a very crazy affair, is the private property of some old lady in the neighborhood, who levies tolls upon the townspeople. Crossing this bridge, on my way back, I saw a notice painted on the gate, cautioning all persons to drive slowly. Under a penalty, if the offender were a white man, of $5, if a negro, 15 stripes. The same decay and gloom that overhang the way by which it is approached hover above the town of Richmond. There are pretty villas and cheerful houses in its streets, and nature smiles upon the country round, but jostling its handsome residences, like slavery itself going hand in hand with many lofty virtues, are deplorable tenements, fences unrepaired, walls crumbling into ruinous heaps. Hinting gloomily at things below the surface, these, and many other tokens of the same description, force themselves upon the notice, and are remembered with depressing influence, when livelier features are forgotten. To those who are happily unaccustomed to them, the countenances in the streets and laboring places too, are shocking. All men who know that there are laws against instructing slaves, of which the pains and penalties greatly exceed in their amount the fines imposed on those who maim and torture them, must be prepared to find their faces very low in the scale of intellectual expression. But the darkness not of skin, but mind which meets the stranger's eye at every turn, the brutalizing and blotting out of all fairer characters traced by nature's hand, immeasurably outdo his worst belief. That traveled creation of the great satirist's brain, who fresh from living among horses, peered from a high casement down upon his own kind with trembling horror, was scarcely more repelled and daunted by the sight than those who look upon some of these faces for the first time must surely be. I left the last of them behind me in the person of a wretched drudge, who, after running to and fro all day till midnight, and moping in his stealthy winks of sleep upon the stairs between whiles, was washing the dark passages at 4 o'clock in the morning, and went upon my way with a grateful heart that I was not doomed to live where slavery was, and had never had my senses blunted to its wrongs and horrors in a slave rock cradle. It had been my intention to proceed by James River and Chesapeake Bay to Baltimore, but one of the steamboats, being absent from her station through some accident, and the means of conveyance being consequently rendered uncertain, we returned to Washington by the way we had come. There were 2 constables on board the steamboat, in pursuit of runaway slaves, and halting there again for one night, went on to Baltimore next afternoon. The most comfortable of all the hotels, of which I had any experience in the United States, and they were not a few, is Barnum's, in that city, where the English traveler will find curtains to his bed. For the first and probably the last time in America, this is a disinterested remark, for I never use them, and where he will be likely to have enough water for washing himself, which is not at all a common case. This capital of the state of Maryland is a bustling, busy town, with a great deal of traffic of various kinds, and in particular of water commerce. That portion of the town which it most favors is none of the cleanest, it is true, but the upper part is of a very different character, and has many agreeable streets and public buildings. The Washington Monument, which is a handsome pillar with a statue on its summit, the Medical College, and the Battle Monument in memory of an engagement with the British at North Point, are the most conspicuous among them. There is a very good prison in this city, and the state penitentiary is also among its institutions. In this latter establishment there were 2 curious cases. One was that of a young man, who had been tried for the murder of his father. The evidence was entirely circumstantial, and was very conflicting and doubtful. Nor was it possible to assign any motive which could have tempted him to the commission of so tremendous a crime. He had been tried twice, and on the second occasion the jury felt so much hesitation in convicting him that they found a verdict of manslaughter, or murder in the second degree, which it could not possibly be, as there had, beyond all doubt, been no quarrel or provocation, and if he were guilty at all, he was unquestionably guilty of murder in its broadest and worst signification. The remarkable feature in the case was that if the unfortunate deceased were not really murdered by his own son of his, he must have been murdered by his own brother. The evidence lay in a most remarkable manner between those two. On all the suspicious points, the dead man's brother was the witness. All the explanations for the prisoner, some of them extremely plausible, went, by construction and inference, to inculcate him as plotting to fix the guilt upon his nephew. It must have been one of them. And the jury had to decide between 2 sets of suspicions, almost equally unnatural, unaccountable, and strange. The other case was that of a man who once went to a certain distiller's and stole a copper measure containing a quantity of liquor. He was pursued and taken with the property in his possession, and was sentenced to 2 years' imprisonment. On coming out of the jail, at the expiration of that term, he went back to the same distiller's and stole the same copper measure containing the same quantity of liquor. There was not the slightest reason to suppose that the man wished to return to prison. Indeed, everything but the commission of the offense made directly against that assumption. There are only two ways of accounting for this extraordinary proceeding. One is that after undergoing so much for this copper measure, he conceived he had established a sort of claim and right to it. The other that, by dint of long thinking about it, had become a monomania with him, and had acquired a fascination which he found it impossible to resist, swelling from an earthly copper gallon into an ethereal golden vat. After remaining here a couple of days, I bound myself to a rigid adherence to the plan I had laid down so recently, and resolved to set forward on our western journey without any more delay. Accordingly, having reduced the luggage within the smallest possible compass by sending back to New York, to be afterwards forwarded to us in Canada, so much of it as was not absolutely wanted, and having procured the necessary credentials to banking houses on the way, and having moreover looked for two evenings at the setting sun, with as well defined an idea of the country before us, as if we had been going to travel into the very center of that planet, we left Baltimore by another railway at 8:30 in the morning, and reached the town of York, some 60 miles off, by the early dinner time of the hotel which was the starting place of the 4-horse coach, wherein we were to proceed to Harrisburg. This conveyance, the box of which I was fortunate enough to secure, had come down to meet us at the railroad station, and was as muddy and cumbersome as usual. As more passengers were waiting for us at the inn door, the coachman observed under his breath, in the usual self-communicative voice, looking the while at his moldy harness, as if it were to that he was addressing himself, "I expect we shall want the big coach." Apostrophe, I could not help wondering within myself what the size of this big coach might be, and how many persons it might be designed to hold, for the vehicle which was too small for our purpose was something larger than two English heavy night coaches, and might have been the twin brother of a French diligence. My speculations were speedily set at rest, however, for as soon as we had dined, there came rumbling up the street, shaking its sides like a corpulent giant, a kind of barge on wheels. After much blundering and backing, it stopped at the door, rolling heavily from side to side when its other motion had ceased, as if it had taken cold in its damp stable, and between that and the having been required in its dropsical old age to move at any faster pace than a walk, were distressed by shortness of wind. If here ain't the Harrisburg mail at last, and dreadful bright, and smart to look at too, apostrophe cried an elderly gentleman in some excitement, darn my mother. Apostrophe apostrophe, I don't know what the sensation of being darned may be, or whether a man's mother has a keener relish or disrelish of the process than anybody else. But if the endurance of this mysterious ceremony by the old lady in question had depended on the accuracy of her son's vision in respect to the abstract brightness and smartness of the Harrisburg mail, she would certainly have undergone its infliction. However, they booked 12 people inside, and the luggage, including such trifles as a large rocking chair and a good-sized dining table, being at length made fast upon the roof, we started off in great state. At the door of another hotel, there was another passenger to be taken up. "Any room, sir?" Apostrophe apostrophe cries the new passenger to the coachman. "Well, there's room enough," apostrophe replies the coachman, without getting down or even looking at him. "There ain't no room at all, sir," apostrophe bawls a gentleman inside, which another gentleman, also inside, confirms by predicting that the attempt to introduce any more passengers won't fit noho. Apostrophe, the new passenger, without any expression of anxiety, looks into the coach, and then looks up at the coachman. "Now, how do you mean to fix it?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, says he, after a pause. "For I must go." Apostrophe, the coachman employs himself in twisting the lash of his whip into a knot, and takes no more notice of the question. clearly signifying that it is anybody's business but his, and that the passengers would do well to fix it among themselves. In this state of things, matters seem to be approximating to a fix of another kind, when another inside passenger in a corner, who is nearly suffocated, cries faintly, "I'll get out." Apostrophe, this is no matter of relief or self-congratulation to the driver, for his immovable philosophy is perfectly undisturbed by anything that happens in the coach. Of all things in the world, the coach would seem to be the very last upon his mind. The exchange is made, however, and then the passenger who has given up his seat makes a third upon the box, seating himself in what he calls the middle, that is, with half his person on my legs, and the other half on the driver's. "Go ahead, Cap'n," apostrophe cries the colonel, who directs. "Go Lang," apostrophe apostrophe cries the cap'n to his company, the horses, and away we go. We took up at a rural bar room, after we had gone a few miles, an intoxicated gentleman who climbed upon the roof among the luggage, and subsequently slipping off without hurting himself, was seen in the distant perspective reeling back to the grog shop, where we had found him. We also parted with more of our freight at different times, so that when we came to change horses, I was again alone outside. The coachmen always change with the horses, and are usually as dirty as the coach. The first was dressed like a very shabby English baker, the second like a Russian peasant. For he wore a loose purple camlet robe, with a fur collar, tied round his waist with a party-colored worsted sash, gray trousers, light blue gloves, and a cap of bearskin. It had by this time come on to rain very heavily, and there was a cold damp mist besides, which penetrated to the skin. I was glad to take advantage of a stoppage, and get down to stretch my legs, shake the water off my greatcoat, and swallow the usual anti-temperance recipe for keeping out the cold. When I mounted to my seat again, I observed a new parcel lying on the coach roof, which I took to be a rather large fiddle in a brown bag. In the course of a few miles, however, I discovered that it had a glazed cap at one end, and a pair of muddy shoes at the other, and further observation demonstrated it to be a small boy in a snuff-colored coat, with his arms quite pinioned to his sides, by deep forcing into his pockets. He was, I presume, a relative or friend of the coachman's, as he lay atop of the luggage with his face towards the rain, and except when a change of position brought his shoes in contact with my hat, he appeared to be asleep. At last, on some occasion of our stopping, this thing slowly upreared itself to the height of 3 feet 6, and fixing its eyes on me, observed in piping accents, with a complacent yawn, half quenched in an obliging air of friendly patronage, "Well now, stranger, I guess you find this amist like an English afternoon, hey?" Apostrophe apostrophe, the scenery, which had been tame enough at first, was, for the last 10 or 12 miles, beautiful. Our road wound through the pleasant valley of the Susquehanna, the river, dotted with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.